Seek healing.
Your strange thing.
Seek healing.
Your strange thing.
Seek healing.
Your strange thing.
Seek healing.
Your strange.
Why? Yeah, man, this is Michael Rose. And when I'm in town, I listen to CKLN 88.1 FM. Don't move your dial. Respect. Why? Ding na ding ding boy.
Pretend this brain is a puny little ant.
Did that hurt?
Nope.
Well, how about this one?
Are you kidding?
Well, how about this?
Unlawful assent.
Good morning, you're listening to CKLN 88.1 FM in Toronto. My name is Shannon, and this is Plunder News for the next hour. We'll be plundering the news, so stick tuned with us. CKLN 88.1 FM, Sunday morning.
This is the meaning of our liberty and our creed, why men and women and children of every race and every faith can join in celebration across this magnificent mall. And why a man whose father less than 60 years ago might not have been served at a local restaurant can now stand before you to take a most sacred oath.
We are a decentralized, nonviolent resistance movement which seeks to restore the rule of law and fight back against the organized criminal class. 0.1% of the population has consolidated wealth in unprecedented fashion and launched an all-out economic war against 99.9% of the population. We are not affiliated with either wing of the two-party oligarchy. We seek an end to the corrupted two-party system by ending the campaign finance and lobbying racket. Above all, we aim to break up the global banking cartel centered at the Federal Reserve, the International Monetary Fund, Bank of International Settlements and World Bank. We demand the primary dealers within the Federal Reserve banking system be broken up and held accountable for rigging markets and destroying the global economy, effective immediately. As a first sign of good faith, we demand Ben Bernanke step down as Federal Reserve Chairman. until our demands are met and a rule of law is restored. We will engage in a relentless campaign of nonviolent, peaceful, civil disobedience. In our next communication, we will announce Operation Empire State Rebellion. Operation Empire State Rebellion. Expect us.
In a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part, you can't even passively take part, and you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop, and you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine won't be prevented from working at all.
Listening to Plunder News, 88.1 FM in Toronto. My name is Shannon on CKLN. All right, so March 27th, 2011. The timeline is radiation spikes near meltdown stabilized. 27,000 lost souls in Japan. The Harper government falls for contempt. And the UN military-industrial complex protecting Libya from Gaddafi. All right, just throwing out a respect to the community and especially the family for the loss of freedom fighter Dudley Laws, who passed on Thursday, March 24th. May his spirit fly away home with love as his wings. Into the sounds from the House of Commons, the floor of the House of Commons on Friday a.m. Ignatius announcing his desire to follow the government for contempt. So we'll get into that, and we'll be right back. This is actually going to take a little while, 15 minutes or so.
The Honorable Leader of the House. because you don't just do speakers. The beginning is the
Vos règlements, your decisions, and have marked the history of our country.
Sometimes with a modest rebuke, sometimes with the sharp sting of focused argument, to understand, to respect, and to cherish the rules of Canadian democracy. And for that, your citizens will always hold you in highest honor. Amen. Mr. Speaker, this is a historic day in the life of Canadian democracy, the democracy that you have served so well. I have to inform the House that the official opposition has lost confidence in the government. Le gouvernement ne jouit.
The government no longer has the confidence of the official opposition.
To agree with a finding in the 27th report of the Standing Committee on Procedure and House Affairs, presented on the 21st of March. This was a historic finding, Mr. Speaker. It was the first time that a parliamentary committee has found the government in contempt. Today, with this motion, we ask the House to do the same, to find the government in contempt, and to withdraw the confidence of the House. Avec cette motion, nous...
With this motion, we are asking members to condemn the government for contempt of Parliament and as a result to withdraw their confidence in this House. This is an important moment, Mr. Speaker, in the history of Canadian democracy, but also this is an opportunity to affirm our attachment to parliamentary democracy and its fundamental principles.
De quel principe?
What principles are we speaking about and referring to? Well, that the government must offer the members all information that they find necessary in order to keep the executive accountable before the Canadian people.
Debate goes to the heart of parliamentary democracy. The obligation of a government to provide members of this House with the information they need in order to hold the government accountable to the people of Canada. We are the people's representatives. When the government spends money, the people have a right to know what it is to be spent on. This Parliament does not issue blank checks. For 4 months, the opposition asked the government to tell the Canadian people the true cost of their budget plan. For 4 months, we demanded to know how much Canadian taxpayers were being asked to pay for fighter jets, for prisons, and for corporate tax breaks. For 4 months, this House and the Canadian people were stonewalled by this government, and they are being stonewalled still. Pendant 4 months.
For 4 months, we have asked the government for accounts, and for 4 months, we ask for the real costs of the jet fighters, of prisons, and of the corporate tax cuts for big major corporations. For 4 months, we've received no answer, but only just the contempt and arrogance of this government. And even today, we haven't received an answer. Mr. Speaker, we were shocked, but we were not surprised. After all, this is the same government that shut down Parliament twice, the same government that was forced by one of your rulings to deliver the documents relating to Afghan detainees, and we're still waiting to see those documents.
The Afghan documents, the government's excuse for withholding the truth was national security. In the case of the budget documents, they invented something about cabinet confidence, but actually they didn't even bother with an excuse at all. But you would have none of it. You held that the rules of our democracy require the government to answer the questions that Parliament wants answered. You sent the matter back to a committee for action, and they came back with a finding of contempt. So this is why we are where we are today. The House must decide whether the government has broken a basic rule of our democracy, and therefore whether it can remain in office. For our part, on this side of the House, there is no doubt. You have spoken, Mr. Speaker, the committee has spoken, and now the House must speak with a clear voice. And it must say that a government that breaks the rules and conceals facts from the Canadian people does not deserve to remain in office. La Chambre doit dire.
The House must speak clearly. A government that does not respect democracy does not deserve to remain in power. Enough is enough. If the result of this vote is an election, the Canadian people will have the opportunity to replace an arrogant government with a government that does respect democracy.
An election is unnecessary. We reply, we did not seek an election. But if we need one to replace a government that doesn't respect democracy with one that does, I can't think of a more necessary election. But Mr. Speaker, it is not just democracy that this House will be called upon to affirm this afternoon. This House should also affirm Canadians' hunger, nay, their longing for change. It's time to change Canada's direction. Time to get us on the right path. After 5 years of Conservative government, it's time to say enough is enough. Enough of the politics of fear. Enough of the politics of division. Enough of the politics of personal destruction. Assez, c'est assez.
Enough is enough.
Monsieur le Président.
Mr. Speaker, look at the priorities of this government. It proposes to spend 1,000 times more on jet fighters than on a help to students who are doing post-secondary education. As to its priorities, we say no. They're offering less to seniors over the whole year than what they spent on the G20 summit. We say no to that waste. The government proposes to spend 1,000 times more on prisons than on crime prevention among youth. We say no, and no again. But this government's priorities do not reflect the priorities of Canadian families. Enough is enough.
Government laid bare in that thin gruel that we saw earlier in this week, reveal a government out of touch and out of control. There is no credible plan to tackle the deficit because there are no numbers any reasonable person can believe in. There is no vision of how to sustain our healthcare system. There is not a word about affordable housing, not a word about childcare, and nothing for the pressing needs of Canadian families in poverty. Instead, we get jets, jails, and giveaways to oil companies, insurance companies, and banks who are doing just fine, thank you very much. So we need a change. We need to focus scarce resources where they really matter. Early learning and childcare, college and university education for all. especially for Aboriginal and immigrant Canadians. Energy efficiency and green jobs. Family care for our loved home and security and dignity in retirement. All of this, plus a clear plan to clean up our country's finances and get us back to balance without adding to the tax burden on Canadian families. Mr. Speaker, these are the priorities of our people. These are the needs that we must serve. These are the priorities at home. But let us not forget the priorities abroad. We have so much ground to catch up. We have a government that has lost our place in the world and lost our place at the Security Council of the United Nations. We need a government that restores our honor, our credit, and our prestige on the international stage. A government that understands the deep and committed internationalism that dwells in the hearts of all Canadian citizens.
You're here. You're here.
Enfin, Monsieur le Président.
Lastly, Mr. Speaker, we need a government for the citizens, accountable to the citizens, in the service of citizens and of democracy. Yes, Mr. Speaker, I always get back to democracy. Members of this government have been accused of election fraud. Someone close to the Prime Minister is accused of influence peddling. That's enough, Mr. Speaker. We can't stand this anymore.
To democracy, to the abuse of power. We have a government whose most senior members stand accused of electoral fraud. We have a prime minister who appointed as his top advisor someone who served prison time for stealing money from his clients, someone who now faces accusations of influence peddling and is under an RCMP investigation. Canadians look at that picture and they say, we have had enough. This House has had enough. Enough of the abuse of power, of the abus de pouvoir, enough of the bad economic choices, les mauvais choix économiques.
Bad economic choices.
Unique distinctions, Mr. President. We have a government with the largest deficit in Canadian history. It is the highest spending government in Canadian history. It is the most wasteful government in Canadian history. And finally, it is the first government in Canadian history to face a vote of contempt in this House. This is a government and a Prime Minister that is out of touch and is out of control. It is time for a change. Monsieur le Président,
Mr. Speaker, I call on all members of Parliament to support our motion.
House to support our motion. Merci. Thank you.
All right. So there it is. The leader of the opposition, or is Michael Ananiev, introducing his motion to the overthrow of the government for contempt. History in the making there, and straight off the floor from Friday the 25th, around 11:30-ish. And the vote did go ahead later in the afternoon. The government did fall, and the Harper government had to tender its resignation or whatever. And the election is on, so beware. Somebody's going to be knocking at your door. I'm looking for your vote. Anyway, got a few articles here. We're going to start with some articles on the actual budget that isn't going to go through this time, but it's much like the previous budgets, and the same arguments seem to apply. A couple of articles here. We're going to start with this one. No one will accuse the Conservatives of having bent over backwards to ensure the survival of their second government. Their budget reads more like a platform of a party looking to fill a 5-week campaign with populist distractions than the main program of a government determined to do heavy lifting over the remainder of its mandate. It reiterates the Conservatives' intentions to rebalance the books by shrinking the size of the federal government, but the cuts they would undertake to wash away the red ink would have been determined later. Over the course of the program review, whose strategic criteria remains unknown. Ditto for the Conservatives' plan on Medicare. The future of the healthcare system is increasingly on the minds of Canadians, but apparently not yet on that of the financial planners of the Harper government, the ex-Harper government. With the federal provincial arrangements on funding healthcare about to come up for renegotiation, this budget offers no fresh clues as to the government's intentions. And it'll be interesting to see if any of these kind of intentions, there's a good question right there. You can ask whoever comes to your door about the negotiation for transfer payments, basically. On the other hand, it's chock full of the kind of bite-sized measurements that are the stuff of the campaign stops of the incumbents will most certainly be made of. These include no less than 6 new tax credits targeted at constituencies that range from seniors to volunteer firefighters. In a spring campaign, expect Prime Minister to reannounce them against the backdrop of potential recipients. The good old photo ops. But while they will provide ample photo op material, there it is, none of these new credits begins to qualify as structural policy. They certainly don't add up to a basis for an adult election conversation about major challenges facing our country. And this article here is about the actual tax cuts, the problem with these little tax credits, I should say. Like many liberal budgets before them, every one of the conservative budgets since 2006 has announced an array of new subsidies to be delivered via the tax system. The individual price tag may seem modest, but they add up to a major drain on revenues. This budget alone would reduce, or the budget that didn't pass, would have reduced federal revenues by almost $300 million per year once the new proposed tax cuts were in full phase. Now catch this. All of the new credits are non-refundable, meaning they benefit only those with enough income to pay taxes. This leaves out a surprisingly large chunk of the population. The latest data available from the Canadian Revenue Association shows that in 2009, almost 34% of the individuals who filed returns had no tax payable, 28% men, 39% women. That means that new credits are of no help whatsoever to a full third of the tax filers, most of them at the bottom of the earnings scale. So in reality, these concessions are targeted at middle and upper income earners. Perhaps we do not want to help these folks, or perhaps we do want to help these folks with their tuition, caregiving, or medical expenses, but it makes little sense to exclude the neediest citizens from these programs. Yet this so often is the effect of delivering subsidies through the tax system. It's time for Canadian politicians and voters alike to grow up about tax expenditures. Little breaks may seem nice if you happen to be part of a favorite group, but ultimately they destroy the simplicity and fairness for all of us. And incidentally, they also make it hard for governments to reduce the general rates that apply to all taxpayers or to fund programs for the most needy. So in the next election campaign, instead of focusing on who will get the batch of tax goodies, we should ask legislators what they will do to halt the uncontrolled growth of tax expenditures. And that's an article from Elisa Phillips, professor of tax law, Osgoode Hall, York University. And, so there's a couple articles there on a budget that didn't happen. It's 9 a.m., so I'm going to run this next piece. It's from Democracy Now! On Iraq. A lady, I believe, named Asselbali is definitely presenting the alternative argument. You know, what should we have done in Libya? I meant Libya. What should we have done in Libya? Well, this one here, I'll let you know. This is the alternative, the one that the UN military-industrial complex missed due to the fact that they're the military-industrial complex and not the UN anymore. So if they were the UN, they would or should have done. And you're listening to Plunder News, 88.1 FM in Toronto. My name's Shannon. And, yep, We'll be right back after this. And we'll be right back after this piece from Democracy Now!
To discuss the situation, we're joined by Asla Bali. Professor Bali teaches international law at the UCLA School of Law. She's written and commented extensively on the question of international intervention in Libya.
Yeah, I think that basically the way to think about the authorization that the Security Council engaged in is that a decision was taken as to a tactic to be employed here, namely use of force with a relatively open-ended mandate from the skies without a clear strategy and certainly without any consensus as to what that strategy is going to be. So as Professor Matawa just suggested, for some people the strategy here is regime change. There's no alternative, as he suggested. For others, it's pushing Gaddafi's forces back to some more acceptable line outside of the eastern provinces and then imposing perhaps a ceasefire. At that point, all bets are basically off, from what I can gather. It doesn't seem as if there's much thinking beyond this. So either on the one hand, you exceed what the Security Council has authorized by pursuing regime change, or you pursue what the Security Council has authorized, namely a ceasefire, and you risk potentially freezing a situation on the ground that results in some form of partition. I think these are the kinds of criticisms that are really worth engaging in thinking about this particular intervention. The question shouldn't be, should there have been some intervention to end the killing of civilians? I think we can all agree that the killing of civilians is deeply problematic. The question is, what is a constructive way to stop that from happening? Aerial bombardment risks ongoing civilian casualties. So there's a whole host of ways in which to think about this no-fly zone or no-drive zone, or however you think about the use of force that's been authorized from the skies. Connecting that to the goal of ending the killing of civilians is, I think, difficult to manage. You know, one thing that commentators have pointed out, and I think this is right, is when you have readily mobilized air resources, then that appears to be the solution to many kinds of problems. In other words, if you have a big hammer, everything looks like a nail. But in this instance, having committed to this particular tactic, I think what we're seeing now is the absence of a clear strategy. I think it's encouraging that Secretary of State Clinton suggested that there are negotiations, potentially back channels, taking place to have the Gaddafi regime exit and some negotiated transition out into exile. That would be, I think, an ideal outcome from all perspectives, in terms of a rapid transition to a post-Qaddafi scenario that doesn't involve more shedding of blood. There were many ways to get to that scenario that would not have entailed even the first Security Council authorization, since, for example, the ICC referral, the referral to the International Criminal Court, is counterproductive insofar as it says to the regime that you're going to face a form of international accountability that disincentivizes exile, that disincentivizes the regime from leaving rapidly. So from the outset, I feel as if the Security Council's interventions in this instance have been, I think, poorly framed if the goal here has been rapid transition to a post-Qaddafi scenario with sparing of the civilian population of killing. One more thing I just wanted to add on President Obama's comments, since you asked. He notes that one thing that we're pursuing here beyond humanitarian considerations is some degree of international and American leadership in the context of the Arab democratic uprisings. And while I think it's certainly important to support those uprisings, I think there are a number of other motivations that one needs to consider in putting on the table. For one thing, I would challenge Professor Matawa's assessment that the situation in Libya has a causal relationship to the decision to use force in Yemen or Bahrain. Those outcomes were taking place simultaneously, and we have, for the most part, the same coalition of forces that are prepared to intervene in the Libyan case are more or less supporting both the Bahraini and the Yemeni regime's strategies. And I think that's a very troubling intervention of its own in the course of Arab democratic uprisings. In addition, I think that there were considerations in the Libyan case, the isolation of the regime, the fact that it represents a relatively weak military force with very few allies in the region, the fact that it borders on the Mediterranean and gives rise to the possibility of major migration flows to Europe should there be a long, protracted conflict there, and that it sits atop energy resources that would destabilize energy markets. I mean, I think these are all important considerations that, frankly, we have to concede are among the motivations. That's not to say that any intervention is bad because of mixed motivations. That's not the argument. But one has to be clear-eyed about why it is that this coalition has been willing to proceed in this instance and is not, on the other hand, prepared to intervene, let alone forcefully in any way, really, politically, with response to the repression that we're seeing in Bahrain and Yemen. I don't know if the strategy continues that we're seeing now, and we do, in fact, continue the no-fly zone and insist on a ceasefire line, which is what the Security Council authorizes, the resolution authorizes. It's hard to know what other result would come other than a partition at this point.
And what would that mean?
Well, that's a very open-ended question. I mean, that's precisely the thing around which there is no strategy at this point that I can identify. It doesn't appear to be any consensus around either partition or regime change among the allies that are undertaking this action.
Khaled Mattawa, we just have a minute.
All right, there you go. Amy Goodman from Democracy Now! With Asil Bali, UCLA law professor. And she obviously presenting an intellectual argument there on the basically deficiencies of the UN policy regarding the bombing of Libya. Basically, partition is on the horizon. All right, I've got this here article. This one's from Martin Rigg Cohen, a Queen's Park columnist from The Star. Ontario's debt is soaring, the province is falling behind. So the I believe the Dwight Duncan will be releasing the Ontario budget this week coming up, so look forward to that in advance. We got this little report on the debt in Ontario, and this report coming from the Ontario Financing Authority. $40 billion in annual borrowing to finance an unprecedented debt of $236 billion, including the old hydro debt. This net debt, or the net debt after accounting for assets, comes to about $220 billion. So if Ontario was to go out of business today, we would owe the world $220 billion, or about $17,000 per every man, woman, and child in Ontario. $17,000 per person is our debt in Ontario alone. That's negating the federal debt, which we get into some other time. The credit rating agency Standard & Poor's has put the province on notice that its credibility is in question and has privately voiced skepticism over the ability to meet expenditure and wage constraint targets, according to an internal Ontario Financing Authority document circulated last month. To avoid running out of money if markets freeze up, Ontario has been keeping about $20 billion on hand for the province's liquid reserve. If the record low interest rates go up, the province will pay the price. Interest paid on Ontario's debt in 2010 to 11 fiscal year ending this month will probably be near $10 billion just to cover the interest on the debt. That's 8% of the total government expenditures. Ontario's net debt as a percentage of GDP, or gross domestic product, the size of the economy, was 33% in 2009/10, and not far behind Ireland. Ontario's debt to revenue ratio now exceeds 200%. Debt to revenue. I'm not even sure what that means. It sounds high. The numbers are depressing but not surprising. Ontario didn't boost the debt on a whim. It deliberately primed the pump during the brutal recession to keep the auto industry afloat and the economy on life support, just as the federal government did, though Ottawa boasts a higher credit rating and vows to end the deficit sooner. So we can look forward to Dwight Duncan releasing his budget next week. Keep it in mind that we all owe $17,000 per to cover the existing debt, and we'll be going further into debt once the next budget comes down, if the next government doesn't fall. All right, there's some few issues on nuclear safety, but I don't know if I'm running out of time here. I'm going to run the next piece, another one from... By the way, there are meetings going on at the Hope Fellowship Church on Bloor Street in Cortez in the next week or two, and Greenpeace was there to let us all know, chaining themselves to the desks and then being removed eventually. And there's been lots of action down there, including the fact that the commission, Ontario Power Generation, are not sure if they're building 2 or 4 nuclear reactors, but they are assured that they are building them, even though they're having public consultation at this point. Their mind is made up. So I guess you just go down there to protest and make your voice be heard, but that the government won't listen. Meanwhile, the government will cancel the proposed wind generation program. They're going to put that through studies and put that all on hold for wind generation. But nuclear generation, in light of the 27,000 and the near wipeout of Japan, like if the wind was blowing the other way, Japan could be inhabitable, whatever. So on the whim of the wind, Japan may survive. But of course, somebody else will die down the line. The nuclear radiation doesn't go away. It stays in the system. It breaks down. It dilutes. But the particles are still there. And just to sort of... one of the experts did make a presentation at the hearings in Cortes. Dr. Helen Caldicott, veteran nuclear anti-nuclear campaigner and founder of the Physicians for Social Responsibility, can't understand how can be quite so calm about radiation or so calmly rational about nuclear power. Increasing background radiation is going to increase cancer. And get this, every male in the Northern Hemisphere has a tiny load of plutonium in his testicles from nuclear weapons testing days, Caldicott says, as men in the audience squirm. If a man is cremated, she observes, the plutonium goes up the chimney where it can be breathed in by another man and lodged in his testicles. She goes on to say life is sacred and even includes words from Albert Einstein that nuclear power is a hell of a way to boil water. The 1986 Chernobyl nuclear accident contaminated wide swaths of Europe and led to millions of deaths of cancer and other diseases, and children are still being born with deformities never seen before. Don't eat Turkish apricots. The radioactive candy reactors turn out tritium, radioactive variation of hydrogen that can't be contained by steel or concrete and ends up in drinking water near nuclear plants. It concentrates in DNA molecules and isn't picked up by standard radiation detectors. All forms of radiation being released add up. We're increasing background radiation like there's no tomorrow. There's no telling what form of damage that increased radiation is going to do to humanity, she said, because the mutations it causes in human genes will take many generations, if not hundreds of years, to manifest themselves. Cancers take up to 5 to 6 years to show up, she said. We are on the precipice of absolute destruction in Japan, she said. That's when I keep saying she said, I mean Dr. Helen Caldicott, making a presentation to the panel in Cortes regarding the nuclear development in Ontario that is going ahead, despite the fact that we're looking at 27,000 lost dead souls. It all depends on the way the wind blows in Japan, whether or not Japan will become uninhabitable. Yeah, so meanwhile, and the U.S. has got people moved out 80 kilometers zone, which pretty much pushes the Darlington nuclear reactor fallout down to like Hamilton, eh? So that means pretty much Toronto will be wiped out. Perhaps that's the plan of the federal government, courtesy of the provincial government. I guess they don't really need us that bad, even though we are the primary source of financing. Okay, I go through that again. It's 9:14. We got to do some stuff. So I'm going to drop this piece on Syria. Regardless of the politics behind it, there's an interesting piece here from a gentleman. We're going to find out about... All right, so this is an old-time freedom fighter in Syria speaking to Democracy Now!, and we'll be right back.
Joining us on the phone from Damascus, Syria, is one of Syria's best-known human rights defenders, Haitham Mala. He's 80 years old, an attorney, former judge, founder of the Human Rights Association in Syria, released from prison earlier this month after being held for a year and a half on charges that he weakened national morale. He was previously imprisoned without being tried or charged between 1980 and 1987. He's been barred from leaving Syria since 2004. We're going to begin in Damascus with Haitham Mala. What do you understand is taking place right now? Describe the crackdown.
If I want to talk about democracy, and if we go back for 1949, we started as democracy regime in 45, but the first dictator military regime was created by American embassy in Damascus. You can see that in the Game of Nations written by Mike Scopeland. Anyway, We are from 50 years under emergency case. The country ruled by police, security, intelligence services, and so on. And all laws is forgotten because we have emergency case. The regime and the secret police said if we have emergency case, so we do not need any law. So for that, they put people in jail for nothing. We have now more than 4,000 prisoners in several jails without any charge. You see, we have 15 branches of intelligence services. Each branch work in the same case without any connected between all these branches. So the situation in Syria is very bad in this side. And the people paid in the past high tax for free. I mean, in 80s, when I been in jail for 7 years, when I was in the bar associations of lawyers, Hafez al-Assad canceled the associations, all the bars, and he created a private law to make all the bars follow Baath Party and something like this or intelligence services. So now we try to repeat to ask for our freedom, for democracy in Syria, and we see what happened in Tunis, in Egypt. So the people in Syria is a part of the Arabic people all over the Arabic world. It starts not only in south of Damascus; it starts in several cities in Syria, but the regime always try to use the high punishment by everything, by army, by secret police, by everything, and they arrest the people for nothing, for anything. You know what happened in front of Minister of Interior. People try to ask for to release their one of their family in jail. So thousands of secret police punish them, pull them through the street till the car, and then took them to jail. So this is the background of the system. They did not understand in politics. They did not understand in negotiate. They understand only in force. So how we can be changed is a big question.
Well, Haitham Mala, you've been jailed repeatedly. Back in 2006, you were jailed for 10 days for insulting the president. How has the government been able to justify now these emergency powers that go back more than 40 years to 1963? What does it tell the people why they must keep these emergency powers?
They have to move because we have also to pay the tax for free. Any nation all over the world paid the tax before us. And now we must believe that we must pay the tax for free. There is no way because this regime did not understand anything. Myself, I sent several messages by several ways to President Bashar al-Assad, about eight messages, and also I met the high level of intelligence services or ministers. I talk with everybody. This way is wrong. We have to change. But till now, I have no answer.
Yeah. You're listening to Plunder News, 88.1 FM in Toronto. My name is Shannon. It's 9:20. Yeah. We'll have the In the Red around the corner at 9:30. All right, so moving on. I don't know if you were listening at the beginning of our show. We played this little manifesto regarding the overthrow of the financial dictatorship that we live under, courtesy of Anonymous 99. And their piece and called, let's back up here. Operation Empire State Rebellion has launched its first communication, and Anonymous announced will release evidence of fraud by Bank of America on Monday. That's this Monday, March 28th. The Anonymous 99 will be releasing evidence of fraud by Bank of America And that'll be interesting to see. So keep your eye open for that. I'm going to play a piece from about them, and we'll be right back to actually finish off the show. You listen to Plunder News, 88.1 FM in Toronto. My name is Shannon. And this one here is Anonymous 99. Watch out their action tomorrow. They were responsible for some denial of service attacks in the past, and sort of an anonymous protest group, I guess, based in America, and they're fighting the globalists. So let's hear what they're saying.
And progressive governor of New Jersey, Woodrow Wilson is intent on solving America's domestic problems by eliminating what he considers special privilege and by curbing the power of the monopolies. He calls his program The New Freedom.
The Federal Reserve is a cartel made up of the major banks in America, and they are the ones that are running the show.
Operation Empire State Rebellion is enacted. We are under siege by the banks and their cohorts. We are entrapped in moats of debt, and they have turned our government against us. Democracy and liberty erode in the face of their choleric assault. Thus it seems that there is no way to break the insidious monster that slowly strangles our economy, throwing millions into poverty and desperation. Class and money are irrelevant in the eyes of eternity. Stand up for your brothers and sisters who have no voice. Stand up for those who are being silenced. On March 28, we will place the great instrument of those who assault liberty, the Federal Reserve, under siege. To do this, the people must rise. Knowledge is power. On March 28, join the alliance of Americans who aim to seize the control of money from a few dominant men and place it back under the watchful eyes of democracy. Protest at your nearest federal bank location, conveniently located in New York, Boston, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., Richmond, Dallas, Atlanta, Kansas City, Chicago, Minneapolis, San Francisco, and Cleveland. A brave patriot named Thomas Jefferson once wrote, "The spirit of resistance to government is so valuable on certain occasions that I wish it to always be kept alive." Americans, the spirit of resistance has faded. Awaken your souls and make our nation proud and free once again. This is Operation Empire State Rebellion. This is Anonymous. You are Anonymous. We are Legion. Expect us.
Not investment houses, just commercial banks alone made some $700 billion in profit. A lot of money. Now, as a result of the greed, recklessness, perhaps illegal behavior on the part of a relatively of Wall Street, they are coming to the taxpayers for huge bailouts, and we have no idea how much that's going to end up costing. These guys made unbelievable sums of money. Then through their greed and recklessness, they created a terrible crisis, and now we have to bail them out. Where did all their profits go?
So who got the money?
To financial institutions in Europe and other countries.
Which ones?
I don't know.
$500 billion, and you don't know who got the money?
The loan went to the loans go to the central banks, and they then put them out to their institutions to try to bring down short-term interest rates in dollar markets around the world.
Well, let's start with which central banks got the money.
There are 14 of them, which are listed in our, I'm sure they're listed in here somewhere.
Many, again, of my constituents, I think people all over this country, are wondering why the CEOs of these large financial institutions who have been extremely greedy, reckless, and maybe have engaged in illegal behavior have not been fired so that we can work with people who want to really reform the system. Should the CEOs of the financial institutions that have led us into this deep, deep recession be fired?
Well, pay and job tenure should depend on performance, and those that should perform poorly should lose their jobs.
Any of them who have been...
Many have lost their jobs.
Yeah, most of them, of the major guys, are still holding their positions.
This spirit of greed to continue to drive us into economic holes. How long? Not long. Let this reverberate from Main Street to Wall Street. This day, like Dr. Martin Luther King said, we will be able to speed up that day when all God's children, blacks and whites, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, Buddhists, Hindus and Muslims, will be able to join hands and say, we are free from economic shackles, free from lining your pockets, free from predatory lending. I stand here with my colleague and we join hands and say, enough is enough.
All right, that's Anonymous 99. And they should be releasing evidence of bank fraud by Bank of America tomorrow. All right, things to do. We need to radical reawakening. We need to reestablish bottom-up participatory democracy. Think about generational sustainability. Organize, decentralize. And remember, no radiation is safe. You vote every day with your money. Use cash, not credit, and you'll feel better. Invest locally. Bank at a local credit union. Eat real food, mostly vegetables. Look for products with less than 5 ingredients. Eat organic and you'll avoid GMO. You can contact me at plundernews@bell.net. That's plundernews@bell.net. And thanks to sources, Parley, the Parliament site there on gc.canada. And Toronto Star, Lisa Phillips, Chantel Hubert, Catherine Porter, John Spears with reports on Helen Caldicott, Martin Ray Cohen, Democracy Now! For a couple pieces. We have music from Pilot Magic, included Lupe Fiasco is in the background. Hey Lupe, and we're going to go out with this Jay-Z and Empire State of Mind. Don't forget tomorrow, Empire State Rebellion tomorrow, A99. And In the Red is coming up next. Till next week, signing off, this is Shannon for Plunder News, 88.1 FM in Toronto.
Yeah, I'm up at Brooklyn, now I'm down in Tribeca, right next to the Narrow, but I'll be hood forever. I'm the new Sinatra, and since I made it here, I can make it anywhere. Yeah, they love me everywhere. I used to cop in Harlem, all of my Dominicanos right there up on Broadway. Pulled me back to that McDonald's, took it to my stash spot, 560 State Street. Catch me in the kitchen like a Simmons whipping pastry. Cruising down A Street, off-white Lexus, driving so slow, but BK is from Texas. Me, I'm up at Bed-Stuy, home of that boy Biggie. Now I live on Billboard, and I brought my boys with me. Say what up to Tata, still sipping my top, sitting courtside, Knicks and Nets give me high five. Nigga, I be spiked out, I could trip a referee. Tell by my attitude that I most definitely from at a Yankee game. Shit, I made the Yankee hat more famous than a Yankee can. You should know I bleed blue, but I ain't a crypto. But I got a gang of niggas walking with my click though. Welcome to the melting pot. Corners where we selling rock. Africa been by the shit. Home of the hip-hop. Yellow cap, gypsy cap, dollar cap, holla back. For foreigners, it ain't fair. They act like they forgot how to act. 8 million stories out there in the naked. City is a pity. Half of y'all won't make it. Me, I got a plug special and I got it made. If Jesus paying LeBron, I'm paying Dwayne Wade. 3 dice, CeeLo, 3 card, Marley, Labor Day.